Every Woman is a feminist show about women and girls making a difference, and the men and boys in our lives. As 53% of the world's population, of eligible U.S. voters, and 50% of the world's population, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote for nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, staff, volunteers, board, or sponsors. Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart in the studio today with Alice Kitchen, a co-chair of the Women's Equality Coalition, Women's Equality Week Coalition, and Karen Beth Zacharias, a history professor at St. Mary's College in she can correct me if I get this wrong, Leavenworth.
Right.
And also an attorney. And they're going to talk to us today about CEDAW, the Convention to End Discrimination Against Women. But first, we have Ebony with some news for us today.
We do, Sharon. Women around the world hold first mass international women's strike, build A Day Without Women, in protest against pay gaps and violence. Women closed schools, occupied farms, descended on parliaments, and went on strike in countries across the globe in one of the most highly charged and political International Women's Day days in living memory. The first mass international women's strike closed schools in the United States and child care centers in Australia as women took industrial action to highlight the gender pay gap and show solidarity with the global women's movement. The strike marked the first major action since the global women's marches on January 21st, which attracted up to 2 million people onto the streets to protest against violence against women, inequality, oppression, and misogyny. For the strike, which was organized by international women's strike organizers of the Women's March and hundreds of human rights and women's campaigns, supporters were urged to strike from paid and unpaid labor, buy local and wear red, and other country-specific colors in solidarity, The Guardian reported March 8th. Understanding better how women are affected by disasters, economic shocks, and other crises is key to helping their communities ride out pressures, including climate change, a top resilience expert says. But putting them in the driver's seat to deal with the problems is equally crucial, she said. Sundai Bridget Jones, Senior Associate Director with the Rockefeller Foundation, said women are often resourceful in finding ways for their families to bounce back from disasters. After the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, for instance, she said, many women started projects to earn a living after losing their men to the disaster. More women should be given leadership roles in efforts to reduce future risk, she said from New York in an interview. There is a lot more that can be done, Bridget Jones, who leads an international development and gender equality for the New York-based foundation. She said more efforts to understand shocks and stresses from a woman's point of view are greatly needed. Bridget Jones said she hoped a Rockefeller Foundation-backed program to get at least 100 women heading Fortune 500 companies by 2025, up from around a quarter of that now, would also foster new thinking about resilience, including ideas about how to protect supply chains from disasters, Reuters reported March 8th. And on March the 11th, 1993, Janet Reno was confirmed as the first woman to be U.S. Attorney General. And now we will go back with our guests.
I listened to Ebony's news, and it just kind of makes me roil inside. I can get so angry thinking about how second-class women are in this United States and in some parts of the world. In some parts of the world, women have it a lot better standing than they do in the United States, and which kind of brings us to the Convention to End Discrimination Against Women, which was introduced
in 1974. It has an interesting history, though. Women's rights have always been part of the discussion at the United Nations. Obviously, you have the UN Charter, the Declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in which women were included in that conversation. But people came increasingly to realize that women were easily left out of the conversation. So the Commission on the Status of Women began to push towards this idea that we would have something that was more concrete, something that specifically laid out this idea. And so the Commission on the Status of Women decided to draft a comprehensive charter in 1974. And the United States was at the table when it was drafted. And the United States was deeply involved in it, and on the 18th of December of 1979, the UN adopted the Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which is called CEDAW. And on the 3rd of September 1981, it was entered into force, and then President Jimmy Carter signed it. And that is where the story stops in terms of moving it from something that had been signed by the president to something that has been ratified by Congress.
So it needs to be ratified by Congress, and does this get brought forward every year to Congress?
It has had a hard time getting out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. For decades, Jesse Helms held it up, and then there was hope when Joe Biden was the new chair, and unfortunately in 2002, when he did finally manage to move it forward out of the Foreign Relations Committee, the Bush administration squished it.
Okay.
And that's where it's.
And what year was that?
2002.
And so in any action since then, nothing?
Nothing that moves it forward in any real way at all, mm-hmm. No. So, but there have been other exciting movements as people have looked at the federal level and said, we aren't seeing the movement that we need. You know, women oftentimes roll up their sleeves and look at a different way to approach it, and that's the grassroots level. So some exciting developments that I think that Alice can probably talk best about, but some of the exciting developments have been the idea that cities, in other words, if you can't get it on the federal level, let's look and see what this would look like, the outline, the infrastructure, the principles of CEDAW, what they would look like on city levels. So San Francisco was the first to pass a Cities for CEDAW set of ordinances in 1998. And now across the United States, we have some real movement at that grassroots level. Hopefully that we move it up as opposed to something that will move down.
And it is on the table in Kansas City, Missouri, I think.
Yes, it is. And on the big picture, the goal is 100 cities by 2020, and now I think we have 20 that are moving forward with strong programs with an ordinance, and I think 44 are like Kansas City. We have a resolution that was unanimously passed in December of 2014. Cities like Lexington, Kentucky are working on it, Salt Lake City. Those are the cities that we can relate to because they're more of our population size and some of the politics of the local community. So we have the resolution. We have met with the staff of the mayor's office and talked about this. But you just don't get this blessing or this credential without the conditions that are required, which I think we are proud of because there are strong traditions that have evidence that women have equal status and are safe in their communities. So the resolution that was passed was in supportive of this enactment, which we call CEDAW. And CEDAW, again, is not a bird. It is the word Convention to Eliminate the Discrimination Against Women. And at the national level, I just want to say that other countries that have passed it and have gone back and reported in their investigations and examinations, the standards are high and the evaluations move you forward to keep meeting higher benchmarks. And that's what we want. We want to be in the queue or in the line to be evaluating ourselves and bringing our equity standards up higher. So the conditions that get you into the formal lineup of official cities for CEDAW would be that you have an ordinance, and that means city legislation, that you would, and in Kansas City that includes 300 miles and numerous different jurisdictions north of the river and south of the river. But that includes that you have a gender analysis. That's the foundation, and that means that you have to have an independent study of the status of women in the and their pay within city government. And we have worked with the University of Missouri at Kansas City with their staff. They've developed one, and the UM system in Columbia is participating, and we're working with the Women's Foundation. The challenges are if the city will fully participate or if they will be reluctant partners. We have talked to them. We've said we're coming back. Many of the women city council members and men council members have been supportive. And, you know, this is not a big ticket item. Some cities have women's commissions in their city governments, and they actually are fully staffed and work year-round. But we're at the starting point. We need an analysis, which is basically like what you have in business. It's a quality improvement plan, starting with the baseline information of women, job categories, pay, the relationship to what they do in the job, and their experience, that all ranks into the formula that shows that. I think Kansas City will be surprised to find that they have good quality equity payment for some categories, and in other categories they don't. I think in the areas where women are in unions, they probably have the same pay, but we just don't know, and we won't be able to move forward without that, and that's the expectation. After we get that, then we evaluate what needs to happen in terms of women, their safety, prevention of domestic violence, and handling it quickly when it does. Then we'll be able to track, and then all eyes will be on moving it forward. And it provides a model for other cities in our municipality to follow and shape according to the jurisdictions that they have.
I believe I have heard, perhaps through the Women's Foundation or another organization, I can't come up with the name of it, but that we have made improvements in women in leadership in corporations in Kansas City, Missouri.
Foundation, Women's Foundation and the City of Kansas City have a WE project, WE Initiative, and they have moved to get women on boards and commissions in both Missouri and Kansas. And I think they have made progress in that area.
Sharon, you know, yes. We'll have Wendy Dahl next week, so we could ask her from the Women's Foundation.
Oh, great. Yes, because they have a new report out.
Yes, the Women's Progress, it's been updated, the Women's Progress Report for the women in Missouri, and so they've updated, so she'll be here to discuss the updates.
And Ebony, be sure to ask about the previous governor's statement and administrative decision on women in the workforce and their pay. At the state level, it was an administrative order, and I think it continues on into different administrations. But it's a real sign of progress, and these are the places that it matters. We need women on commissions and boards, but we need women in the council chambers making the decisions, voting, and we need them in the higher ranks of decision makers in city departments, as well as other businesses.
It's shocking to me, and we didn't mention, how many countries have not passed CEDAW.
So the United States is in kind of very small company. We are the only industrialized nation that hasn't. We are ranked right with Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, Iran, Tonga, and Palau as the only countries on Earth that have not, as of, this was as of 2015, July of 2015, that have not signed the CEDAW. And there's a lot of actual misinformation about what it would do. One of the huge conversations, as you can imagine has to do with women's reproductive choices. And one of the ways to immediately kill almost anything in the United States is to suggest that it somehow is pro-choice in any way. In fact, it does not address the issue at all. And countries that at the time signed on, such as Ireland, Burkina Faso, and Rwanda, that are not, that do not allow certain reproductive choices for women. It also suggests that, you know, one of the other fictions, because you always have to have a whole set of fictions, is why we can't do something, is that it would interfere with the proper role of parents to child rearing. And in fact, it does not interfere with the role of parents to children. In fact, the treaty itself doesn't insist on a set of guidelines. It's not a law that says you have to sign on and these are the laws. What it does, as Alice said, is it sets up benchmarks. So it says, what are the laws of your country? How do you meet these benchmarks? In other words, if domestic violence, which is illegal almost everywhere, then how are you measuring that? How are you assessing that? And how do you meet a higher benchmarks? If you have things like pay equity and you're arguing that, in fact, women should be paid equal pay for equal work, then let's measure that. Is that how that really works? And so you report back. So the measurement is actually a measurement against your own set of legal standards.
And, of course, we're falling down desperately in all of those.
And we are. You know, what are we, 47th in the world in maternal health? And, I mean, really, we should not close our eyes to the idea that it is important to understand where we are.
Let's pause here for a moment. We have as guest today Karen Beth Zacharias and Alice Kitchen. We're talking about a convention to end discrimination, all discrimination against women. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Sunday evenings at Californo's in Westport features live music by Kansas City jazz staple Rich Hill on piano from 6 to 9 p.m. Supporting KKFI, Californo's restaurant offers a full bistro menu including wine and grilled steaks with fireside seating. Rich Hill, every Sunday evening at Californo's in Westport. You can discover our menu and browse private event spaces online at californos.com.
Well, they had to call the doctor and the doctor had to strap you down.
Women Rising Radio with Healers at Standing Rock. Making Contact Thursday at 12:30.
And we're back on Every Woman, and we're talking about CEDAW, the Convention to End Discrimination Against Women. And I wanted to kind of back up a little bit. One of the excuses used for everything is reproductive freedom, that isn't something that women are able to decide for themselves. And I'm, you know, it's like you ask yourself, what is it? Do men hate women so badly? Why? I was at the initial meeting of the Women's Equality Week organizing meeting on Thursday, and I said to the women there, why aren't we angrier? What is the problem here? Why? And everyone spoke up and said, we are angry. And I was telling Ebony, I drove in with her today, that are women just supposed to be so nice that we just sit back and we just take it, and we take it, and we take it, and then we turn the other cheek and take it some more? Why are men so hell-bent, and I guess some women too, on keeping full rights from women? Do we have any answers for that?
Well, it's an interesting... I'm going to be a historian for a minute, put on my historian hat, and when people start yawning, I can say, okay, I've taught enough. But if you go back, way back, Code of Hammurabi, you know, really, really far back, what society was very interested in was controlling a woman's womb, because that had to do with inheritance. So very early on in laws, you can see where the conversation about protection of women who are young women, virgins, so you could track and understand what that the child that you believe to be you, if you're a man, yours, if you're a man, was in fact yours. And so it had a lot to do with inheritance. And you can look at, you know, ancient laws, whether they're Hebrew, whether they're the Code of Hammurabi, others, where you really see this kind of focus. It wasn't as much controlling the woman per se, but it was controlling the life that she had the potential to provide and making sure that that life actually was a child that you, if you were as a male, had participated in creating or not. And so, you know, it has a very ancient idea of what people are trying to control. As it moves forward, though, and you look increasingly at women having control of themselves, you have this, it gets all tied up and mixed up into these really patriarchal systems, but also patriarchal legal systems. And so, you know, it's a set of circumstances that you can drive the line from ancient to modern and have the same kind of a fairly complex conversation. And it is why women, I think, are still struggling to come to terms in terms of the fact that their bodies, all of their bodies, are their own, just like a man's body, all of his body is his own. And but I am often struck, as when I teach, you know, World Civ 1, and we're looking at very old laws, that there again is this fairly lengthy body of law that has to do with controlling the womb.
And I would just add that in some cultures, like in Native American culture and in China, there are some small subsets of women's lives where these laws and these historic traditions do not continue, which they're rare, but they're out there. Let me just read a postcard that I think says a lot of it. Women pay the price for the decisions made by men. Of the 50 million displaced people from their homelands, 80% are women and children. Of the 1.3 billion people living on less than $1 a day, 70% are women. Sex trafficking is one of the highest grossing industries worldwide. And among the hungriest people in the world, 60% are women.
It's just, Ebony, do you want to jump in here?
I know, Sharon, I feel you on that. It may, just listening to some of the conversation, I'm reminded of when I heard someone say, you know, you can't legislate morality. And that kind of stuck with me, and this was years ago, but it just came up for me now. I'm not saying that we don't need an effort to change the laws, but just like in a corporation or any organization, there's one thing on paper and then there's the way that people actually behave. You know, whether they write it down as a law or not, the actual behavior that's going on. And Sharon, you asked the question, why, you know, kind of like why women are what, you know, why is this going on? But I also think what would really change some of the, I guess, the hearts and minds, if you will, of enough people to make these changes actually happen. You know what I mean? Like, just besides, well, let's make this a law not to do this. Well, there are a lot of laws not to do a lot of things, and we still have a lot of it going on. And so that's what I kind of come to, how do we get to the heart of the matter where you really, what is that connection that needs to take place?
I do think it's the 50-50 participation, maybe not even 50-50. They say critical mass is a 30%. If we had 30% women in leadership roles, it would make a magnificent difference. But we need to work harder to get our feet in the door and in charge and making laws and voting on laws, I think that's probably the biggest key.
And, you know, it's an interesting thing because, so people will say, well, okay, so what if you had 30% of women on boards or 30% of women, you know, voices? Two things. One, when we were at the UN several years ago, a woman from Germany got up and said that they now have a rule that 30% of boards need to be women. And some man said, well, wait, that will change the power structure of those boards. And she said, do you think? Yes, that's exactly the point. But the other thing is what else does it put in the conversation? When we were looking at this wonderful woman who spoke about the CEDAW initiative in San Francisco, and one of the things that they discovered is that when you have women who make the choice about light poles in a neighborhood, that they will put those light poles closer together, because for a woman, light after dark is a function of safety. Men are less concerned about that. So, in other words, if you're looking at a budget, and a budget is a budget, the city doesn't have more money than the city has, but if you're looking and you put women in part of the conversation, the woman says, well, look, I think that greater light would provide a lot more safety in our neighborhoods, and it would make women feel safer, so that those of us that work the night shifts or, you know, swing shifts and are coming home, that pool of light to light is an important conversation for us. If men weren't part of that conversation, they would never think about that. So it's not sometimes changing these enormous things. It's thinking about how the conversation is different because of women.
Karen Beth, tell the story, maybe the same city, where they had a very low number of workers in one category.
It is in San Francisco. So one of the things they did was they did in their gender analysis of the city of San Francisco. One of the things that they noticed that women didn't work in basically waste disposal. And those were some of the higher paying jobs in the city. So why didn't you see women working in them? So they had that conversation. What they discovered was that job started at 6 a.m. And most women, particularly women who, if they were single mothers, they didn't have daycare for that 6 a.m. slot. So what they figured out was if they did a rolling start, some people started at 6, some people started at 7, some people started at 8, then women would bid into those jobs and have the opportunity to participate in those jobs, because there was just this adjustment. So the budget wasn't different, but the access that women had to participate in those jobs was different. It wasn't that they weren't interested in them, but childcare and getting their children off to school was really a critical factor. So by having women in that conversation, by having women participate in these conversations, it is possible to look at the way that work is done and think about how work is done, whether that excludes or includes half the world's population.
You've just been listening to Karen Beth Zacharias from St. Mary's University, a history professor and expert in CEDAW, and also you're at the Center for Peace and Justice.
So I'm the director of the Lawrence D. Starr Center for Peace and Justice in our Global Society at the University of St. Mary, which is a wonderful program that we are very fortunate to have, and then I am the non-U.S. historian, so all but the U.S. I have the world.
And Alice Kitchen, co-chair of the Women's Equality Week Coalition. And we're going to try to get these two women to join us on Every Woman as regular contributors and supporters, and that will be just great.
Sure, and I'd like to follow up on the point that Ebony made. Well, first of all, Mary Sanchez wrote a really important column on March the 4th in the Kansas City Star about a time to revive the Equal Rights Amendment. And to the question and the point about, well, we have regulations and laws, but, you know, nobody pays attention to them. And that's the problem of enforcement and how that happens. And so that can be remedied. And there's some laws and regulations that should be deleted, like spitting on the street or, you know, standing on the corner at a certain hour. There's lots of those, and I'd be happy to have them go. And, you know, like decriminalization of marijuana and things like that. But the Equal Rights Amendment does need to be in law. We need the law. And I can tell you why. I get real passionate about this. If you read the book, Jessica Neuer's book, Equal Means Equal, the point is that if you remember the Walmart case, it was a huge class action lawsuit. And it's about women in upward mobility in their roles at Walmart, which we know is the largest employer in the world, I think that.
That's right.
And so they filed this class action lawsuit. And do you remember what the Supreme Court did with it? They couldn't figure out what to do with it, so they just passed the buck on it. The UPS case was the case of a woman who was in the, doing the driving and the lifting and the storage around the boxes and packages and so forth. And when she got pregnant, her doctor put her on bed rest or on less activity duty. And she protested because that affected her job status and her payroll and everything. That case went to the Supreme Court, and it did not pass. Because both of these cases, I cite, the reason is that if we had the Equal Rights Amendment, they would have passed. We would have prevailed. Remedies would have been enacted, and we would have been watching. The other one, which is also tragic, I mean, the number of women in the Walmart case was, I don't know, a large number. It was so large. And you can just see the bureaucracy and all the social elements that impacted that. And, again, that would have changed the way things work in business, I think. The last case is the one of Jessica Gonzalez in Colorado. And she was a victim of domestic violence, and she had three young children. And she got a court order, which is a piece of paper that if you have it and the perpetrator is beating you, it doesn't do any good, but when the police come, they can arrest him for violating a court order. She reported it to the city. She said, I'm at risk. I have this court order. And she called the police, and they didn't come. And the end result was that her three children were killed and her husband shot himself. She's living, and she's living with all of that. And the law didn't protect her. Law enforcement didn't respond. She took it to court after court, prevailed all the way up to the Supreme Court, and she lost.
Because women don't have protection under the law. We're an unprotected class.
That's right. So we need the Equal Rights Amendment. And if you ask where we are on that, there's a variety of interpretations, and we need three more states to sign on to it. And there is a Senate bill in the Senate. There are two of them, SJ-5 and SJ-6. And we have met personally with Senator Blunt's office here in Kansas City and Senator McCaskill's office. And they both need to sign on and support us. They need to step up. And we women have got to insist and push and not accept anything until that is done. It is extremely important. And if anything, the Women's March, where women all over the world, Antarctica, New Zealand, were out there saying, we need our rights, and we're going to take them.
So it's interesting, this past week, we have seen two instances, in fact, where women, another highlighting, one is the women who have filed suit for sexual harassment suits against Kay Jewelers. That was a big news. And then the other big news this week were the Facebook posts of 30,000 Marines who had apparently a large number had been taking pictures of women without their knowledge in various forms of undress and posting them in a closed Facebook system. And this appears to be much more pervasive than was originally thought. So these are prime examples as Alice mentioned, a woman is more likely domestic violence and its relationship to guns and domestic violence is a terrible litany of the stories of women and guns.
Which brings me to the point, it just never ceases to amaze me that these males who proclaim to love life of the unborn so much then could not stand to be without their guns. And it's almost like they want to be sure there are enough babies born so there'll be people to kill at some future time. I just can't figure out why they can't see the idiocy of letting everyone on the street carry guns, open carry, college universities, wherever you want to go, and yet then proclaim to the womb to protect the baby in the womb until it hits the ground, and then there's no support for the mother. It makes me speechless.
I was, when Pope Francis came and spoke to Congress several years ago, I was, obviously the Catholic Church has a very specific position on life and where it begins. Pope Francis also had a very specific position about life and how it should end. Mm. He was very specifically speaking of the death penalty in this case, but he also more holistically spoke about what it means to consider life precious. And I often go back and reflect on that, you know, because he is someone who has spoken eloquently about the value, the worth, and the protection of these 80% women and children who are refugees around the world. The eloquence of feeding the hungry, of caring, so I think so frequently of the importance for healthcare, the importance of making sure that we have strong safety nets for hungry children, hungry families, safety, good, strong programs for against domestic violence, all of the kinds of things that CEDAW and Equal Rights Amendment. I mean, he is. I won't dare to speak with for Pope Francis, but he is certainly someone who has advocated in his way within the scope of the Catholic Church, but he has certainly advocated for the extraordinary importance of the preciousness of all life, not simply the life of the unborn, but the life of all. And so certainly that is something that... as you mentioned, when we look at the disproportionate way in which laws impact women, the disproportionate way in which laws impact girls, I think that it's fair to raise those extraordinary issues, whether those be guns, whether they be domestic violence laws, whether they be equal employment. You know, what does equal employment mean? Does it mean that you're paying the same person the same wage for the same job, or does it mean that all people have the opportunity to do the job? I listened to Alexis from Stand Up KC, and several of the women that have been so passionate about the importance of an equal. A minimum raise in the minimum wage here in Kansas City. And what they were talking about was the people that cook in the back, that they have a better, they get more money than the people that stand on the line and take the orders. So if you're a fast food worker and you're standing at the register and you're taking the order, you don't make as much money as a cook. But they want to put the girls in the front to take the orders. They want to be the cook because the cook gets 50 cents or a dollar more an hour than they do. So they don't have the same opportunity to those higher paying jobs. And that is where, that's the nefarious kind of hidden
That certainly is hidden because I had no idea. I thought a fast food worker, if Burger King paid $8.65 an hour, I thought everybody at Burger King got $8.65 an hour.
Well, and I would add that in Missouri, the minimum wage is $7.70. And right now in the state legislature, there are two bills that are being pushed to prevent the city of Kansas City, St. Louis, or any municipalities from making decisions of their own. Local decision-making is going to be scrapped if we don't oppose it. But anyway, the minimum wage is very important to both Kansas City and St. Louis, and we've made numerous strides to make that happen. So call your legislator about HB 1193 and 1194. Those are bills that will take away what we always pride ourselves on, local decision-making. You know, the cities are the social engines of our country. They're where things really, you know, the rubber meets the road, the saying goes. It's where things happen. This is where we live. This is where our neighborhoods are. And if you can't, if you're making $7.70 and you have three children and you have to have two or three jobs and they don't care what your hours are in one job or the other, or that you have three children, or that you're sick, because you don't get paid unless you come to work. So, and then sexual abuse in those work sites are often, they're not maybe as overt, but they are subtle. They are from the customers. They're from the co-workers, those that have higher power structures. And we've had young workers come and tell us, and older women come and tell us about their plight. They've been in the food business for a long time. And still, if we value families and children, they're getting no pay.
I guess we did have a victory when the guy, it was the Burger King guy, wasn't it, that he was, that Trump was going to put.
Carl's Jr. and Hardee's.
Yes.
Yeah. Amazing. We lucked out on that one, I guess. But so much needs to be done and changed.
It is, as Alice said, it can be confusing. On one hand, you have someone who is now in charge of the Department of Education who wants to drive local choice as, you know, kind of at the micro level. And the flip side of that is you have the state, which is trying to say, well, okay, yeah, that's fine for education, but for pay, we must have a state wage. And so they're going to have to find the same platform, I guess, is. But then this is why we have courts, and this is why it is really important also that we pay a great deal of attention. I don't know that people necessarily spend this much time with this, but I know I'm guilty of this as well. Not all judges are elected, but sometimes judges are elected. And it's really important to pay attention to, if you get the opportunity to vote for judges, find out who they are. Find out what their past rulings have been. See what their ideas are on some things, because judges matter. They are, when you want your day in court, you want to understand who that judge is. We have a new Supreme Court judge that has been nominated. It is important that we listen when his hearings occur, and it's important that we listen. There will be a lot of discussion that will come up about some of the issues, the very issues that we've talked about here today. It's important that we listen to what he says, that we understand who he is, and then as our elected officials, Senator Blunt, Senator McCaskill on the other side, Senator Roberts or Senator Moran, get ready to vote, that you call them and you say, hey, I have problems with this, or hey, I don't, but whatever, let your voice be heard. So if I make a plug for everybody should vote, but also make a plug for everyone should be informed, and don't just skip by the judges. Judges are extraordinarily important. Let's understand who they are.
And it's important to, after we vote, we then have to still stay engaged.
Yes, absolutely.
And make those phone calls and let those people that we've elected or that have been elected, maybe we didn't elect them, maybe we didn't vote for them, but we still need to tell them what we want them to do, because regardless of whether we voted for them, they are still supposed to be representing the majority of the people. And sometimes I think the majority is too silent. I don't believe that all of us obviously all of us didn't vote for Trump. 3 million more people voted for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. He did not get the popular vote. And by some fluke, whether we weren't paying attention, I don't know, but we really fell down in this last election, and now we have to make up for it. And I'm going to put in a plug for Indivisible KC. I know they're doing a lot of great work. Yes. And organizing a lot of visits, and Alice has something she wants to talk.
Yes.
About.
I would like to remind you, and for your callers out there, if you can get a pencil, I'll give you some information. This coming Wednesday, March 15th, from 5 p.m. to 7:30 at UMKC, Student Union, Room 402, we're going to have the documentary screening of Equal Means Equal. Again, that is UMKC. It's free of charge, and it is Wednesday, March 15th, 5 p.m., Student Union, Room 402. If you have any questions, I'll leave this flyer here in the studio.
Great. And we're going to take another short break now, and we'll be right back with Karen Beth Zacharias, St. Mary's College, CEDAW, and Alice Kitchen, a Women's Equality Week Coalition co-chair.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Maintaining liberty and freedom in a time of terror is always difficult, and we have made some dreadful mistakes. Think of what happened to people of Japanese ancestry on the West Coast in World War II. I think we learned from our mistakes. We won't make that mistake again.
Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
Remember to set your clocks ahead 1 hour tonight. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Heart, and you're listening to Every Woman with Ebony Johnson. Amy's out today studying or working on a paper. She's getting a lot of work done on this paper that's due in a very short period of time. Law school is very difficult, I understand. Oh, yes, you're an attorney. You would know about
that.
Well,
now, I should clarify. I went to law school. I didn't take the bar. I went from law school to graduate school. So I have a JD, but I am not an attorney. I don't practice law. I think law. My students will tell
you.
That's
an interesting distinction, yes. And that's Karen Beth Zacharias and Alice Kitchen. And we should invite people who are out there listening, if they would like to call in. The number here is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI-5534, if you'd like to call in and make a comment or ask a question, because we obviously have some knowledgeable people here talking today. I would like to bring up something that I heard. This is rather controversial, but it made me stop and think, and I think there's a lot to this. Someone at the Women's Equality Week Coalition initial meeting the other day, talking about abortion rights, said that one of the reasons, and there may be many, but one of the reasons that they might be wanting to do away with abortion for women is that basically the people in charge in this country, and no bones about it, they're white men, are worried about the numbers of brown people. I mean, in the world, white people are a minority. I don't know what the percentage is, but I know we're a great minority in the world. But still in the United States, we're the majority. But that's coming, that's lessening. And if we take away a white woman's or women's right to abortion, since there are more white women, there are probably going to be more white babies born. So if we take away the right for a woman to have an abortion, we'll have babies, versus if a woman has the right to abortion, maybe more white women will choose it because maybe they can afford it, because it still comes down to affordability to be able to have an abortion.
But the demographics show that that's happening unrelated to that. The fastest growing population in this country are minorities, and they are the youngest and the most fertile. And so I think it's inevitable. And you look at the rest of the world, and the average age of the population is 25. In Africa and South America, they're young. And so the fertility of that population will grow. And also, I think white women have fewer babies. I think that's the case. And so I think it's evolving and related to what you're suggesting. But it may be underneath of it.
I do think, too, and this is one of the things that I think actually got us in trouble the last election. I think it is, while men, and certainly white men, have had their share of comments about rape and pregnancy that is just beyond human comprehension on some level, I think that it is important that we listen to the voices of women of any color who have different views on conception and birth and life and choice and when that begins as women. I think it is a complicated issue. We like it to be very straightforward, and everyone has their place that they draw that line, and I think that that's fine. But I do think that one of the difficulties that we have had is that we don't listen to the other side. This is, as I think we refer to often, as a civil war issue. You're either in the South or you're in the North, but there's no middle. But someplace we have to begin to listen to each other and understand why certain women believe that this is absolutely, you know, the overturn of Roe versus Wade, they are willing to give up virtually everything to get that particular decision overturned. And there are other women that absolutely will, on the other side, give up virtually everything to prevent that from happening. So, I mean, this is a really difficult place. And I agree. I get very tired of having what is it that Tina Fey said? Old white men with bad comb-overs having, you know, conversations about it. But I do think it is a place where women having conversations and listening instead of reacting would be a great place for us to begin to understand. Because women from different faiths will have different positions on this. And I want to hear what those, you know, what those conversations look like.
You know, and I'm not sure what I would do had I had to make that decision. All I am sure of is the thought that somebody could tell me it wasn't my decision to make is what makes me madder than hell. And I don't care what somebody else chooses or does or doesn't do, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. don't tell me what right. I can do.
Yeah.
And I think that's a super good point. I just would like to listen to the voices.
If anybody wants to call in, we have just now. We don't really have very much time. You'd have to make it a quick call. It's 816-931-5534. And we're here talking about the Convention to End Discrimination Against Women. And I do believe we have a caller, if we can get that person transferred to the air. Caller? Okay, just about. Caller, you're on the air. Can you tell us your name and what part of town you're calling from? Are you there? Caller? Oh, there's a call coming in now. Maybe we lost him. Oh, yeah, looks like we did.
Yes, you're still there.
Okay, we're working on this. Our guests today are Karen Beth Zacharias and Alice Kitchen. And we're working on getting this caller on the air. Be patient here. Caller, you're on the air. What part of town are you calling from? What's your first name? Hello?
Yes, hello?
Oh, hello, yes. Yes, did you want to...
I'm sorry. I wanted to just add, because abortion is a very sensitive issue, and sometimes women in distress situations is forced, impregnated, and then they sometimes they don't want to make that choice, but because of poverty levels, they have to make that choice. When so many people who have had money and privilege have abused that choice because they want to hide things from their family. So abortion issue, I feel like, should never be taken away from us as a choice as a woman, no matter what your color is.
Thank you for that comment. And like I said, you know, I don't want to make that choice for someone else, and I'm not sure what I would do had I had to make that choice. But just the idea of not having that as a choice just makes me mad.
I mean, just exactly, because on two sides of the fence, been a teenage mom since I was 15, and my mom's religion made me keep that. Even though my daughter and myself is grateful that I went through that, had I been 15 and had that choice, I probably would have did that, because at that time it was too stressful in the 90s to be a teenage mom. And then teachers, parents, teachers, a lot of organizations that once educated people, nutrition classes, things that once educated my era in the 90s is not even here anymore. So then you have babies, and then we're creating even that much more statistical data for people to say why they could not fund and why people don't want to work. No, if you eliminate resources all around the way, then how can a person take care of their child?
Right. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your call and for listening
to KKFI.
Thank
you for having this discussion today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you.
We are out of time, actually. I believe we have just been joined by Donna Wolf in the studio, and we are thanking Karen Beth Zacharias and Alice Kitchen for coming in today and having this discussion, and hopefully we've stirred some of you to want to get mad.
There you go.
It's okay. When I became a feminist, I went to my first consciousness raising thing, and I came to it late in life, age 50, before I came to. And I went to this meeting, and I said, I'm angry. And the woman there said, good, now you can get busy and get to work. You know, you have to, anger's okay.
Yes.
It helps us take action. So we'll sign off with that today, and
thank you.
Urban Connection is coming up next, and guess who's coming to Kansas City?